Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program our friend Dr. Amy Stone from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to be talking about something quite important today, vaccinations. Cats and dogs need vaccines to prevent a number of diseases, and we're going to be talking about that for the next hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call. Our telephone number is area code 352-392-8989. Animal Airwaves Live is coming up after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My name is Dana Hill. I'm happy to welcome back to the program our good friend Dr. Amy Stone from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to be talking today about vaccinations, why vaccinations are important, and why how they work, actually. That's one of the first questions we're going to talk about. So welcome to the program, Dr. Stone. So glad to have you back.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
I want to begin with just a real general question, which is, what are vaccines and how do vaccines work?
Sure. So vaccines are, in my mind at least, a tool. Vaccines are a tool to prevent infectious disease. And that's all they are. They are not intended, well, at least in the purposes that we're talking about here today. They're not intended to be the reason to take your animal to the veterinarian. They are intended to be a part of what the veterinarian uses to keep your animal healthy. Mm-hmm. And vaccination is a targeted immune response is what we're trying to evoke using vaccination. We put in a chemical or we put in a type of virus or we put in a type of bacteria or we put in a piece of a protein from one of those things or even a component of one of those things into an animal with the idea of getting a targeted immune response back that's going to prevent that infectious disease.
Okay, so you're attempting to simulate the disease in the body of the animal.
Yes.
In hopes of making that animal's body think that it has the disease and send out whatever kind of antibodies or whatever it is that attacks the virus or the bacteria, and ultimately it builds up an immunity so that when the animal is actually exposed to the real thing, it will not be affected.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So there are vaccines for a host of different ailments, right?
Oh, yes. And growing all the time. There's vaccinations. At one time, there were about 25 different vaccines available on the market for dogs and cats. And now that number is grown exponentially. So there's, you know, different companies make the same vaccine in terms of the same, trying to get immunity to the same disease, but they do it a little differently. So one company might have one type of technology and another company might have a different type of technology. And what you need to know as a veterinarian is what's appropriate for your patient.
Okay. Now, I should take this opportunity at the top of the program to give out our telephone number because we'll be taking calls in a little bit. Our telephone number here is area code 352-392-8989. So let's then start with talking about some of the ways that you are able to, or scientists in general, are able to simulate these diseases in the vaccines.
So you can take some vaccines and some pathogens are, you can take a small minor amount of them and give that and basically make them a little weakened and give that to the animal, and that essentially simulates having that disease.
Okay.
And those vaccines provide really good immunity.
Okay.
The other ways you can do that are to take the whole organism and kill it so that it's not active, it's not alive, and then vaccinate with that. And the immune system's also going to see that and be able to produce, in that case, mostly antibodies toward that organism. Even down to taking a piece of a protein from that organism and using that. You have to know what the body usually goes after. You need to know what the immune system typically sees so that you know how to give that vaccine. But you can do that. You can make a protein and actually use that to simulate the immunity.
Okay. Let's try and frame this in a way that I can understand it. Maybe it'll help the listeners too. Take the human influenza virus, right? They have every year a new flu vaccine.
Sure.
How does that vaccine work? Is that a mild version of the flu, or is that a killed flu?
It depends on which vaccine you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
They have a couple of different types out. So in the killed version, basically what they do is put in the flu virus is very active and it changes every year. It makes itself different. And so they need to have the body be able to target different things every year. And so they change it up. And so some people get a vaccine that goes in their arm, under the skin, or in the muscle, as the case may be in humans, and that their body then is able to target that new flu every year. Some people get it across the mucous membranes.
Mm-hmm.
So kids
that's like
often
inhaled.
Yep. And so it's sort of and many times with the vaccines we use in veterinary medicine, you're going to be simulating the way that the animal would get sick. So if they would get sick by inhaling the pathogen, then we're actually giving the pathogen vaccine by inhaling.
Okay. So in animal medicine, then, some vaccines are administered as shots,
uh-huh.
and some are administered what?
Some are administered in the nose.
In
some
the
are
nose.
Dripped into the across the mucous membranes of the nose,
uh-huh.
and now there are some that are oral.
Okay, and do these vary depending on what disease it is that you're targeting?
Absolutely.
Okay, so why then would you choose to administer a vaccine orally, or would it be because the animal might ingest the disease through eating it?
Sure. Well, what would happen is if you have a disease that the animal would typically get sick by having the mucous membranes affected, there's
mm-hmm.
type of immunity that goes to the mucous membranes.
Okay.
And you want to simulate that kind of immunity.
Okay.
And so by giving it across the mucous membranes, which is the mouth and the nose, that kind of thing, then you are able to stimulate more of a natural immune response, which is going to be more protective and also quicker than by injecting it underneath the skin.
I see. Okay. Maybe it would be helpful then to talk about some of the different vaccines that are available for the different conditions. We're going to be primarily talking about dogs and cats today. I know that on the show before, we've discussed vaccinations of horses. But today, so let's talk about dogs and cats, because a lot of people have dogs and cats, and every once in a while, you have to take your animal in to get its vaccines along with a regular checkup. So what are some of the major vaccines, the diseases that they are intended to prevent, and how are they administered?
Sure. So I'm going to take this time to say that there are two, the American Animal Hospital Association and the American Association of Feline Practitioners have come up with a concept of core versus non-core vaccines. So core vaccines are vaccines that we pretty much want to put in every kitten or puppy so that they get immunized to those organisms right away.
Mm-hmm.
And those organisms have a really big likelihood of that animal coming in contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like in people, measles, mumps, rubella, that kind of thing. So we're talking about feline panleukopenia, canine parvovirus, distemper virus, things like that. Those are the things we're talking about when I say that. The other thing we're talking about is rabies.
Rabies.
And rabies is, fairly fatal
right.
in every animal, so including humans, and very zoonotic, which means that we can catch it.
Okay.
So you want to vaccinate those animals because we want to make sure the public's safe, but we also have to vaccinate them because that's a real risk of that animal coming in contact with.
And the rabies vaccine is a shot?
Yes.
Okay.
So the non-core means that there are other pathogens in the world that only certain animals are going to come in contact
mm-hmm.
with. Not every animal is going to have that realistic chance of encountering that.
Okay.
And so you're going to be looking at two different sort of categories of vaccine. And when you want to get those animals you want to figure out which they need, you have to do a risk assessment. You have to ask, what is this animal going to be doing? What is this animal's job? Are they going to be an indoor animal only, never going outside? Are they going to be an agility dog, et cetera?
Okay. I want to get back to that because we're talking then about risk-based assessment. But we also have some phone calls already, and we might as well go to the phones now so we make sure that we can talk to everybody today. We have Janet in Alachua. Janet, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your question, please.
Well, you know what? My husband and I, we were talking, and we heard that after an animal is vaccinated, and we have a fairly large piece of property, and we have Labradors, and we have them vaccinated every year. One's about 8, one's 9, and one's 7. And there's been some talk that people say, well, you know, you've done be vaccinated every year or every 3 years. Rabies, different ball of wax.
Janet, can I stop you for just a moment? Could you repeat the first part of your question? We didn't hear it.
Are the dogs in general, I mean, especially when they get up there in age, 8, 9, 10, don't they build up an immunity at one point to parvo and different things?
Okay.
So I'm going to answer your question by just sort of talking in general terms about my patients. So whenever I have an animal that is older that is coming in to see me and that has been well vaccinated its whole life, if they're realistically not coming in contact anymore with the pathogens that we're talking about, so if they never ever leave your yard and nothing ever comes in your yard that would have parvo, then we probably are not talking about vaccinating them all the time for distemper and parvo. But I bet there are animals that come onto your property that may have a disease called leptospirosis that's spread by wildlife and things like that. And so they're encountering that disease is probably pretty likely. And so you would want to continue to vaccinate them for that disease because they're encountering it more often. That's sort of the way I think about it. And then by law, we have to vaccinate the way our law tells us about rabies. That's the only one that I don't get to make a medical judgment call.
But Janet was asking whether or not over the years her dogs have built up some sort of I don't know if immunity is the right word, but resistance maybe to some of these.
Well, and there's no evidence that they necessarily build up a resistance, but vaccines like your distemper parvo vaccine are very good vaccines. They actually get a long-term immunity in most animals. The problem is you don't know which animals those are unless you do. You can do titers. That doesn't give you the entire story. But again, if your animal's not encountering that much, that particular pathogen, then whatever immunity they do have from their vaccines is probably going to be adequate. But if you decide you're going to be rescuing litters of puppies from the shelter, then I'd probably want to start vaccinating your dogs a little more frequently because they're likely to encounter parvovirus or distemper virus.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Janet. I appreciate it. That was a great question.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Let's go to Mark in Gainesville. Mark, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hello.
Hello.
I've had dogs for about 30 years. Never had a burglary since I had a dog.
Good.
The puppy next door was sick. And I freaked out because I hadn't done a parvo distemper vaccination on my big dog for years.
Sure.
So I rushed to the vet, $55. Okay. Now I've got a new dog who needs distemper and parvo, and my big dog needs a repeat. I went to the seed and feed store, and for $7.50, I bought a refrigerated vaccination kit with two vials, a dry powder, and a liquid, and a sterile syringe. And I'm going to inject my dog myself. Why does the vet charge seven times as much as the vaccine costs?
Okay, so I will tell you that so there's a couple of things about getting vaccines at a feed store. When you get vaccines at a feed store, you don't necessarily know how they've been stored before that. And we don't necessarily know if that's still going to be effective, let me put it that way, because there are some vaccines that if they are left in the environment is going to basically inactivate that vaccine to the point where the immune system will no longer see it. So you may not have an effective vaccine at that point. We just don't know. We don't have we weren't able to track that vaccine back from the manufacturer. So that's one point. The other point is that when you bring an animal to me, my goal is not vaccination. So when an animal comes into me every year, that's only a minor component of what I'm doing. I'm making sure that animal's healthy. I'm doing a full exam. I'm making sure that everything about your animal is as healthy as I can get it there. That's my goal is wellness. So vaccine would only be a small part of what I would be doing when your animal came to the veterinarian. And if your animal were to have an adverse reaction, which does happen on occasion, so basically an allergic reaction to that vaccine, then I would have just done an exam on your animal and I'll know what baseline looked like and I'll know what the differences are.
I see.
So you're basically, you know, you can see it as you're paying $55 for the vaccine, but hopefully what you're paying $55 for is the person who's administering it, doing a physical exam, and having all of the other qualities that go with a wellness exam.
Thank you so much for the question, Mark. I really appreciate it. So, Dr. Stone, the vaccines that you get that can be either vaccines that are injected or vaccines that are administered through the mucous membranes, those all come from where? They must come from some medical supply company.
Sure, sure.
And those vaccines are they produced by some of the major like pharmaceutical companies that
yes.
produce human medicine?
Yes.
Yes.
Many of the human pharmaceutical companies have a branch of their company. It's usually a small branch of their company that is designed for animal products.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of them then have a vaccine line that they carry. And again, they all have different technologies that they use to proprietary things they use to make their vaccine slightly different. And they'd like to think slightly more effective, which, you know, may be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that we get those vaccines from those companies.
Mm-hmm. So as Mark was saying, his dog was exposed to, I think, a sick puppy that was next door.
Right.
And that is understandably cause for concern because if your animal is not up to date with all its vaccines, then your animal is potentially at risk, right?
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit more about the risk-based assessment because that was one of the things that Janet mentioned and also Mark's question sort of got to this as well. If your animal is not likely to ever come in contact with wildlife, perhaps it does not need the vaccine that it might
Right. It may not need the leptospirosis vaccine.
Okay.
Absolutely. If it doesn't ever go, you know, if your dog doesn't go drink out of puddles that raccoons and, you know, whatnot have gone through,
right.
then you're probably fine.
Okay.
But if you or other risk for that would be cattle, you know, farms, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if your animal is basically the indoor dog or the indoor cat that doesn't contact other animals much, you're going to want to give them things, again, that vaccines that they're possibly at risk for, which would be that neighbor's dog
mm-hmm.
that, you know, most of us live in with other people around us.
Right.
And so that dog may come in contact with the next door neighbor's dog. And
yes.
so that would be a realistic thing. Distemper, parvo, those kind of things are going to be realistic things that animal may actually encounter.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm talking today with Dr. Amy Stone from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And if you'd like to join the conversation, as Janet and Mark did, our telephone number is area code 352-392-8989. Now, one of the things that I think about, Dr. Stone, is that my kitty, Moggy, lives in the house, and she does not ever get to go outside. And so she's not going to ever have contact with another dog or another cat. However, what am I bringing in the house that could potentially harm her?
Right. So if you're petting other cats or having other cats, you know, rub on you, that kind of thing, and then not cleaning, you know, not getting all of that pathogen off of you, yes, you could potentially bring something back into the house.
What? Oh, this is terrifying because I am friend to cats and
yes, absolutely.
That come around and there's probably like 8 cats in my yard
right.
at any time and I pet them. And
do you ever open the screen?
No, I don't.
No, good.
I don't. And I don't let her like get near them. But I do wash my hands
good.
When I go
Perfect.
Inside. I do wash my hands.
Perfect.
But what if a cat has like rubbed up against my pants?
Yeah, and I mean, if presumably that's going to be a very low risk situation,
okay.
But it, in theory, yes, that could happen.
Oh.
But hopefully, you would watch, and if that cat came up to you with, you know, a really gross nose because it was sick, you wouldn't let it rub on you.
No,
hopefully.
I don't think so. Okay, okay, good. So, but this could be the case. Someone who has an indoor dog or any other sort of animal that it.
I can tell you, my animals are the perfect example. I work with animals that are sick all day long.
Yes.
So, needless to say, I come home and essentially immediately all the clothes go into the dryer or washer and dryer, and you know I'm cleaning myself so that I'm not bringing things home to my animals.
Right. And does that work pretty well?
So far.
Uh huh.
So far, and my animals are vaccinated.
Yes. Okay. So what? Sort of diseases might animals that are indoors be exposed to that they need to make sure that you need to make sure they're vaccinated against, just because even though they don't go outside, it's still risky.
Sure. So those core vaccines that I talked about,
yes.
For cats, we're talking about what's called the FVRCP vaccine that has panleukopenia, herpes, and Khaleesi vaccinations in it. So that would be one.
Could you describe what those diseases are?
They basically can cause a syndrome of very major illness. Panleukopenia causes major illness in cats to where they can have in kittens, it often can cause death, it can cause GI signs, it can cause respiratory signs, it can cause neurologic signs. The other two, Khaleesi and herpes, are mostly a respiratory type illness. And so those are things that are very contagious, and cats are very realistic for cats to come in contact with. And when they're kittens and puppies, and I'm not puppies in the case of cat viruses, but in terms of young animals, they're not going to have immune systems that are developed quite as much an adult. And so if they're even, that your cat decides I'm going to just step out on the porch when you've opened the door, yes, your cat could come in contact with another cat in enough time to catch something,
mm-hmm.
especially when they're young and very susceptible. So when Janet called and said, don't her dogs get some immunity? Yes, just in the fact that the immune system develops to an adult state gives some more immunity to that pet. And so core vaccines for cats are essentially that. They are the FVRCP and rabies, because we know that we have to by law with rabies. And in my mind, for kittens, also the leukemia vaccine.
Okay.
Because kittens are, again, more susceptible because they're young, and they also are a little unpredictable because they're rambunctious and you never know what they're going to do. And the family brings home their groceries and the kid leaves the door open and out pops the cat, and now they're at realistic exposure. Once they're a year old, they never go outside, that the cats calm down, they don't run outside at all, then we'll talk about leaving out the leukemia vaccine.
Yeah.
In dogs, core would be your distemper and parvo and adenovirus and rabies.
Yes.
As well, in my mind, again, when they're puppies, as Bordetella, because they're going to have to come back to you from the time they're 6 weeks of age every 3 to 4 weeks to be vaccinated. And so they're going to have to encounter a veterinarian's office all throughout their puppyhood. So in my mind, at least as puppies, they do need that vaccine.
And what is that?
The Bordetella vaccine is one of the things that can cause kennel cough.
I see. Okay. In a little while, I want to talk about shelter animals, because I think that is an interesting topic. But first, you just described some of the differences between dog and cat vaccine requirements. How different are the vaccine requirements depending on your geographic location? In Florida, do we have some things that we need to be concerned about that we would not if we lived in, say, Minnesota?
Sure. So we'll take Lyme disease, for instance. If you lived up north in Minnesota or over in the Northeast or whatever, you're going to have more exposure to Lyme.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you come down to Florida, we don't really have the one of the hosts that carries Lyme. We don't really have that here.
Mm-hmm.
However, many of our people in the world are now very transient. So we have the snowbirds that come down to our wonderful state for the winter. And if their primary veterinarian happens to be in Florida, then that veterinarian needs to understand that part of the year that animal is going to spend time in a place where Lyme is a possibility.
Yeah. Now, as a veterinarian, do you ask this of your clients?
Absolutely. Taking a risk assessment is probably one of the most important things I do every day.
What does the risk assessment look like? Is it a form that the clients fill out?
It can be. Mm-hmm. Some of us have forms that people check off. Most of the time, it's what's called getting a good history.
Okay.
So I talk to the client. A big part of my exam is talking to the client about what does your animal do?
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, what kind of things do they do for play? Do they board? Do they go to a groomer?
Yeah.
What happens to your animal? And what's a day of your animal's life like? And so we can get an idea of what's realistic for that animal in terms of what they're going to come in contact with.
You just mentioned animals that are boarded. That must be a potential source for... I don't want to alarm anybody. I'm sure that there are many wonderful places where you can board animals, and I'm sure they're conscientious of this. But your animal is likely to be exposed to other animals, right?
Sure. So I'm gonna make an analogy. Cruise ships.
Okay.
Everybody goes on a cruise.
Yeah.
And until Norwalk virus, nobody freaked out that everybody was going to get sick from being exposed to all these people in one place. And again, most of the people that go on cruises don't get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Same with boarding. We're putting a bunch of animals in a very small space, and although you're trying to keep everything clean and separate, there is risk that somebody in that grouping is going to be sick and expose your animal to that disease.
Yeah. You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. We're talking with Dr. Amy Stone about vaccinations. We're also going to take some more of your calls, but first, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more Animal Airwaves Live right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation today with Dr. Amy Stone, is area code 352-392-8989. Now, we're going to go back to the phones here and talk to Ronan Itchituckney. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I appreciate it.
Sure.
Ms. Stone.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Back years ago, back in the 60s, we could buy our injectables, you know, from a feed and seed store, right?
Sure.
You know, rabies and whatever.
Right.
And my Jip had a litter of pups. They were Pit English, Mastiff Cross, and a Rottweiler, which, you know, it gives you the idea.
Yeah, but, totally.
So anyway, I you know, got them the rabies things, and they were like 7 or 8 weeks old when I, you know, bought the stuff and gave it to my dogs, the puppies, I should say. And one dog, the second largest, went into, you know, like everyone just kept running around like they're supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
This one just went down and laid down, and I picked him up, and he was like picking up an alarm clock.
Sure.
And I took him to the vet, and they said he was allergic to it.
Right.
Is there such a thing as being allergic to that lepto? Actually, it's like, I think, two or three vaccines in the same shot?
Sure, sure. We have combination vaccines, and potentially what you gave was what some people colloquially refer to as a 7-in-1, where you would have had a bunch of things in one vaccine, and some of them are things that are adjuvanted, and adjuvants are essentially a secret sauce, is what I call them, that are added to make sure that the immune response sees that pathogen, so that it's trying to stimulate immunity. Sometimes, however, though, that puppy is set up to have a reaction genetically to that to those proteins.
Out of the same litter.
Yep, yep. Because the different genes happen in different animals.
That's why I'm a male and you're a female, right?
Right. Bingo. And so, I'm allergic to certain things that my parents aren't allergic to. You know, my husband's allergic to things that his sisters are not allergic to. So it can happen. Now, it's more likely, it's impressive that only one of your puppies had that response, but it can happen to other animals in the litter as well.
And so his question about allergic reactions to vaccines. Are these common, allergic reactions to vaccines?
They do happen. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say they're very common, but they do happen. And it's something that we call it adverse events. There's many different types of them. They could have that allergic response like he's talking about, anaphylaxis, where mm-hmm. you know the entire immune system goes on alert. They can also just have a swelling as a part of that. They can have, breakout in hives, those kind of things. And so we know that there is a segment of the population of animals that's going to have a reaction to vaccination.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the question, Rowan. Really appreciate you joining the program. Now, let's go back to the phones and talk to Mark in Bellevue. Mark, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hey, Dana.
Hey.
Hey, Dr. Stone.
Hi.
Hi. This is a little bit off topic, but it's kind of still... Have you noticed in your practice and your patients, for lack of a better term, have you noticed a bad problem with ticks this season? Because we had such a mild winter, and it didn't really kill them off. I mean, I've lived in Florida for 30-some-odd years, and I have seen more ticks on my animals, and they're both of my dogs are on the, one of the prescription flea and tick medications. But I have been picking ticks off of my dogs for the last month, I mean, probably a couple dozen every other day. Have you seen an increase in the ticks this time of year?
I have, and I want to say good for you that you're looking every day at your dogs to pick those ticks off. We've had a big bumper crop of ticks this year. You're right. The mild winter did not do us well with having ticks. And ticks are very difficult to keep off of animals. We're better as a profession at getting fleas off of animals than we are at getting ticks off. Ticks are just very difficult to keep away from dogs. They're at the right level. They're much better hosts for ticks than we are. So it has been difficult. And I think doing what you're doing, which is diligence of making sure the ticks get off of the dog, is going to be the main way to do it, as well as using other, prescription flea and tick preventatives.
And ticks carry what diseases that we need to be concerned
ticks
about?
Ticks carry many diseases we need to be concerned about. Lyme, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, mm-hmm. lots of things.
And so Mark would do well to ensure that his dogs are vaccinated against these things, right?
The things that we do have vaccines for, yes, he would do well. But also just doing what he's doing, which is get the ticks off every 24 hours, making sure those ticks don't have time to stay on there very long is the way to go.
Well, way to go, Mark. I really appreciate your call, and good for you for being so consistent with checking on your animals. So, Dr. Stone, we're learning more about the vaccines here, and I wanted to ask, are there any differences in the different diseases, the way diseases can affect different breeds of the same animals? Because you were just talking about genetics. So what I wonder is, if are some breeds of dogs more affected by some diseases and therefore require different vaccinations than other breeds of dogs?
So basically, we know that in human beings, some humans have a good response to vaccination in that they get immunized to whatever you're vaccinating them for. Some dogs and cats work the same way that they, most do, that they have a good response to vaccination and become immunized. But you don't know whether it be the genetics of that animal, mm-hmm. whether it be the way the vaccine was stored, whether it be that animal had a concurrent illness going on, whether there's lots of things that could cause a failure of immunization. And one of those things is genetic differences. And there was for a while in the 80s, a group of dogs, we used to think, we called it the black and tan syndrome, mm-hmm. where Rottweilers, Dobermans, different breeds like that were supposedly more susceptible to parvovirus. And so when we vaccinated, they also tended to not respond to vaccination very well. They mm-hmm. didn't actually get immunized. Their immune system just didn't do anything with that information. And so we know that those groups of dogs, that those lines kind of died out because they all got sick.
Yeah.
And so the nature worked to make sure that the new ones that came along were very resistant, or much more resistant than those animals had been. So yes, there can be differences, but in general, the immune system is the immune system.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. We're talking with Dr. Amy Stone from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine about vaccinations, and our telephone number is area code 352-392-8989. Now, I wonder about the frequency of vaccine administration? It must vary from disease to disease, right? Or,
sure.
Or what you're trying to prevent, right?
Right.
Is there such a thing as a vaccine that sort of like the polio vaccine for that children get, right? That protects you for your life, correct?
Right.
Does that exist with animals?
It may. Mm-hmm. It used to be that the studies that we did in dogs and cats didn't last very long to look at the amount of immunity that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 1 year vaccination interval is what they call it. So telling everybody they needed to come back every year for all the vaccines that animal receives was an arbitrary number.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, we just had to come up with a time frame, and we figured that every year we'd like to see that animal anyway, so
mm-hmm.
every year they should come back for those vaccines. Well, now that we're looking, now that, you know, the companies are helping us, support us to look at how long immunity is lasting, in some animals, you are looking at potentially lifelong immunity from some of our vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
However, you don't know which animals those are.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to sort of try to vaccinate everybody as best you can to make sure the population stays as disease-free as you can possibly make it. And so that's why we now know that some animals, their distemper parvo vaccine that they receive at 16 weeks of age may last their whole life. But we don't know which of those animals were, you know, maybe had parasites at the time, so their immune response didn't respond as well. Or which of those animals had had a cold, and so their immune system didn't respond to their vaccination like they needed to provide that lifelong immunity. So the differences in vaccine interval come from exposure risk. So if I have an animal that's at risk all the time for something, I'm going to consider vaccinating it more often than an animal that's not. Also, it comes from the differences in the vaccine types. So some of the vaccine types more mimic the way natural disease would happen, so they provide longer term immunity than other vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, you're looking at multiple differences in things that make it more important that you have an individualized vaccine plan for every animal based on science and based on that animal's risk. So what may be appropriate for your cat may not be appropriate for my cat.
Okay.
Or what may be appropriate for, you know, my friend's dog may not be appropriate for your dog. So each animal needs to have its own risk assessment and its own vaccination plan.
Are there diseases for that animals get that, like the influenza, change often enough that you have to administer a vaccine with greater frequency because the disease is different?
There are. It's not quite as much of a problem as the influenza in people. We do have influenza in dogs, and we do vaccinate for that. And we don't have as much evidence yet that that's a fairly new discovery that we have an influenza in dogs. And so we're watching how that influenza may be changing and the genetic variation that it may be coming upon to whether or not we're going to need to change our vaccine.
Are there potential consequences in vaccinating animals for diseases to which they have built up some sort of immunity?
In my opinion, so if a dog has just had parvo, vaccinating them for parvo would be sort of silly because they have immunity to parvo. And so you'd sort of be wasting that vaccine in a way.
Right. But let us say that there is an animal which, as we were just talking, has, by having received a vaccine at some point, now it's okay. Now, you say we don't know which animals those could be, but do vaccines in and of themselves carry any risk of causing illness if they're administered unnecessarily?
So if they're, sometimes we've had problems with vaccines, and this is very rare. This does not happen commonly at all, but that animal may get a vaccine that has a virus or a bacteria that's a little more virulent.
Mm-hmm.
And that animal may have a mild case of that virus or that bacteria. And so you might see, after an animal gets aboard a televaccine, you might see some mild coughing or sneezing because they get a mild case of kennel cough. But again, that's a very mild thing, maybe a few days of the sniffles as compared to full-blown disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so by making them have a small case of it, you're actually getting then more immunity to that
right.
that pathogen. So, and we've had cases where there was contamination, again, very early on in making vaccines. And so the scientific world actually gave different diseases to some animals because they were contaminated with another virus or another bacteria. But again, those, we've come a long way in our technology, and that sort of thing is doesn't really happen anymore. Quality control is much better.
Do you think that down the road we will see changes in the vaccination protocol, and maybe vaccines will be administered less frequently or in different ways than they are today?
We've already seen that. From the time the practitioners started putting out vaccination guidelines, and those are really things that tell us how long we can expect immunity, at least to the knowledge that we have, and which vaccines they consider animals more at risk for, you know, the pathogens which they consider animals more at risk for than others, which vaccines are safe, those kinds of things. They started coming out with guidelines in the early part of around 2002, 2003. And so now we have every couple of years new versions of those guidelines come out. And every time they've come out, intervals for vaccination have changed. So we used to go every year and vaccinate with a distemper parvo in dogs every year, and now we go every 3 years once they're adults. In cats, same thing. We used to go with an FERCP every year, and now it's every 3 years. And so we know that those intervals are changing. We also know that we've gone from having an intranasal kennel cough vaccine to now there is one on the market for that's oral.
Mm.
So you don't have to do the either under the skin or through the nose. So there's all sorts of changes that are coming in humans as well as dogs and cats to make vaccinations safer.
Mm-hmm.
Vaccines are safer than they ever have been. For humans and for animals as well. And again, our goal is to vaccinate at the least amount that we can,
okay,
to keep an animal safe.
Okay.
So I don't want to vaccinate every year unless it's something that the immune response is only going to give me immunity for approximately a year.
Let's talk about animals in shelters, because many of us have adopted our pets from the animal services or from the Humane Society or from some other rescue organization. And these organizations all do really great work, and they care about animals and they want to give animals loving homes. But in any sort of confined population of animals, the potential for the spread of disease must be higher than when your animal is just in your house.
Absolutely.
Okay, so my kitty came from the Humane Society there on 6th Street, and she had to go and get an exam right after we adopted her.
Right.
And at that exam, she was given vaccinations, right? So this was critical because of the potential exposure she had, correct?
Right, except that hopefully she was given vaccines when she came into the Humane Society, because we actually want vaccines to happen before they're exposed to disease, if possible. So hopefully she was given vaccines when she came into the Humane Society, and I believe that is their policy.
Right.
And then she was given vaccines for things that she could come in contact with by being in that same vicinity.
Yes.
Maybe not in direct contact with, but being in that same vicinity. So many animals are vaccinated for things like distemper parvo or FERCP when they hit a shelter or a Humane Society. As they're leaving, they're often given then their rabies vaccine, because now they're going out into the world and they could actually come face-to-face and actually have contact with that other animal, and that's how rabies is spread, through bites. So you want to vaccinate on intake to that shelter or to that Humane Society for everything that animal could come in contact with by just being in the vicinity. And many shelters and many Humane Societies and rescue organizations are very good at doing that now.
Okay. So what about giving vaccines to animals with some pre-existing illness? Is that risky?
It is risky. And in a shelter situation, you have to take that chance.
Yeah.
In a shelter situation, to protect that population, you must take that chance. One of the reasons that you bring an animal to a veterinarian when you vaccinate them is that they can look for pre-existing illness and make sure your animal is healthy enough to receive vaccination.
I understand. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Chantal in Ocala. Welcome to the program, Chantal.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask the doctor if she finds there's any correlation between the fact of autoimmune showing up in dogs with vaccines. Is it coincidental, or does she feel that it's more because of better reporting and better logistics in the media as far as notifying when it does occur?
Yeah, this is a really, really great question. And go ahead and answer, Dr. Stone, because this gets to a future program, I think.
Sure,
that we're
gonna do. So one of the adverse events that we like to call them is that an animal could have an autoimmune type response. You know, they could have their platelets drop, or they could have their red blood cells being destroyed by an autoimmune response. And we know that can be in correlation to having a vaccine. Again, it's not an all the time thing. It's a very rare thing. And anytime I am giving a vaccine, I am always aware that I need to make sure that the risk to this animal having an adverse event are lower than the possibility of this animal coming in contact with a disease and actually getting sick. So it's always a cost-benefit analysis in my mind as to, you know, what I'm doing. So to me, vaccination is as serious a procedure as putting an animal under anesthesia for a surgery. It's the same. It is a medical procedure, and I am having to look at what risks there are to this animal and having an adverse event. Also, I am looking at how much this animal's possibility is in coming in contact with a disease and getting sick. So I have to weigh that every time I give a vaccination. And I believe she's right. Chantal brought up a very good point. The media, we now report adverse events to the USDA and to the drug company. Mm-hmm. So those events are getting much better reported. And now with the internet, we have a better way of reporting them. It's much easier. Somebody doesn't have to make a phone call. They just get online and report that event as a veterinarian to the company and to the USDA. And then we get phone calls from those people, and we discuss that event and how it happened and what blood tests we did and all those kind of things. And I do believe the media now is much better at bringing that to the public's attention. And so I don't think the incidence has gone up of having autoimmune responses to vaccines. I think our being aware of it has gone up.
And I should say that one of our future programs with Dr. Stone will be a discussion in which we go over some of the fear in the public's mind of dangers of vaccines, some of which may not be borne out by the actual evidence, I guess.
Right. Okay. We're going to sort of have a point counterpoint on vaccination and why we need it as a useful tool, and then vaccination as it causes adverse events, mm-hmm. and looking at what you do need to be afraid of and what you don't need to be afraid of, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, so I wonder, you said that animals that arrive at shelters will be vaccinated for diseases to which they might be exposed, you know, by being near a bunch of animals. What happens if a pregnant animal arrives at a shelter? What can you do then?
Again, pregnant animals, when they arrive at a shelter, you're going to want to quarantine them, for one thing. You're going to want to have them all by themselves as much as possible, as isolated as you can, for their own protection. But at the same time, I don't like to vaccinate animals that are pregnant, especially not with a live vaccine. So mm-hmm. not with one of those vaccines where we've taken the virus or the bacteria and just made them weak. Because those fetuses can actually, you can have a poor response to the pregnancy and cause things like the animal to miscarry. And so you want to be able to give them vaccines if they're going to be exposed. And so you would try to use a killed product that doesn't have as much of a chance of causing disease and causing something like a miscarriage. However, at times when an animal comes in, so if you don't have the luxury of having a way to isolate that animal and potentially not giving as many vaccines on intake to a shelter, sometimes you have to risk it in mm-hmm. order to protect that whole population.
Yeah.
You know, it's from everybody being sick. Sometimes you do have to take that risk. I'm lucky. I'm not a shelter vet. I admire those who are, because that's a very, very tough job and a very necessary job. But I get to hopefully help my patients by saying, okay, let's plan your dog getting pregnant, and let's plan what vaccines we want to give before she's even bred, so that she's protected and can pass that protection to her puppies in the future, not during pregnancy.
What do you see in the future for vaccinations? Is it possible to vaccinate against all the diseases that animals might get?
No. There are some diseases that do not lend themselves to making a vaccination for them. Such things as the retroviruses. We do have retrovirus vaccines in veterinary medicine. We have one for feline leukemia and one for feline AIDS. But those diseases are very good at hiding from the immune system. It's one of the reasons we don't have a common vaccine for HIV, is that that disease changes and hides from the immune response. And so making a vaccine becomes very, very difficult. And so stimulating the immune response in the way we're used to doing that is going to be not necessarily effective at preventing disease. And so, yes, there's going to be not going to be a time where we protect from everything, but I think there's going to be a time when we're able to protect from more than we are now. And again, the vaccine technologies are changing and growing every single day. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're learning that the important part of coming to the vet is not the vaccine. The important part of coming to the vet is the knowledge that veterinarian has about how to protect your dog from or cat from infectious disease and how to keep that animal healthy in all other ways of their life. That vaccine is a very minor component of why they come to the vet. It's more important when they're young, and as they age, the importance of it, depending on their risk, decreases, because that we're looking more at things like organ failures, older age illnesses, cancer, things like that, as the animal ages, that you're not as worried about because in puppies and kittens, because they're not aged. They have, you know, a baby immune system.
Yeah. And this all gets to the main hope that we have, and that is that our pets live longer.
Amen.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Amy Stone from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us.
Absolutely.
I want to say thank you to Richard Drake for answering the phone. Steve Seip directs the program. I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey. My name is Dana Hill, and we will be back next week with another Animal Airwaves Live.